On today's show, our all-gay panel reviews Milk and discusses gay villages, which is a topic plucked from the themes of the movie. What up, listeners? Welcome to the You Better Represent podcast. Each week, we explore representation in cinema by reviewing a minority-led film with members of that underrepresented community and debate a cultural topic plucked from the movie's themes. I'm your host, Fong Sho, official spokesperson for Gay Super Cute Asians, and I've actually realized I did not say my name any time in the past 2 months on any of these podcasts. So if you're wondering who I am, I am Fong. I guess I've been saying it on the outro, but not the intro. For some weird reason, I accidentally deleted that line. But I am Fong. Joining me for today's show is award-winning filmmaker and comedian Robert Watson.
Milk does a body good, y'all. Hi, Fong.
Hi, Robert. So great to have you on today. And this movie, I'm very excited to jump into it. There's so much around the movie, the themes, the topics. It was really fascinating. So this week's movie of the week, of course, is Milk, which came out in 2008. And it is the story of Harvey Milk and his struggles as an American gay activist who fought for civil rights and became California's first openly gay elected official. It is based on the documentary that came out the year before called The Times of Harvey Milk, which that documentary won tons of awards as well. And it is, and that documentary was loosely based on the biography, The Mayor of Castro Street, which was a book that came out earlier than that. The movie, a really good point for gay representation here is it was directed by Gus Van Sant, who is openly gay, and written by Dustin Lance Black, who is also openly gay. Now, less openly gay are the actors. So we've got Sean Penn as Harvey Milk, Josh Brolin as Dan White, James Franco as Scott Smith, Alison Pill as Anne Cronenberg, and Victor Garber, who actually is gay. Plays Mayor Moscone. So we got one. We got one gay actor. I'll throw it over to you, Robert. What was your experience watching Milk, and what resonated for you the most with this movie?
Well, first of all, what an amazing dramatization of what essentially is an amazing civics lesson for everyone. And if you want to take a good look at what helped start civil rights for gay people in America and perhaps around the world, I think this is a movie that you need to watch, and definitely the documentary as well, if you want a more biographical documentary style. But I really like this film. First of all, like it's an easy film to like because you really want to cheer for Harvey Milk in this movie, even though and then knowing of course the history, because I was one of those gays when I came out, I was like, what's the history of being gay? What has happened before me? And so I've known about Harvey Milk, but this movie really hit home because it gives that personal and intimate knowledge about him. Having Cleve Jones as one of the major consultants on the film. Of course, Cleve Jones played by Emile Hirsch in the film. He was there for the whole thing, for the filming, and even hearing things like that people who experienced, this time, how they all came out as extras for free for this movie was something that I found fascinating. I know I'm not talking about the actual movie itself right now, but the things around it. And just reading that, it was quite a surreal experience for a lot of people because, for one thing, they recreated Castro Camera in the actual spot where Castro Camera was. This was Harvey Milk's camera shop where all of these political ideas and activism sort of had their base. And they rebuilt it in the actual spot. So I was, reading about how people, when it was filming, were walking by and having really emotional responses to seeing that there because it's such an iconic place for people who are watching, the gay rights movement. but I should talk about the movie a little bit more. I think, the intimacy of the scenes between two straight actors, you know, Sean Penn as Harvey and, of course, James Franco playing Scott Smith, were one of the things that really humanized him. And just amazing as a story. Like, this story starts when Harvey Milk is 40. Like, he's had a whole life already. Yeah. And this is, like, spanning 8 years of his life until his unfortunate assassination. And it's just amazing to know that he did so much in 8 years. And he was in the closet before that. Moved to San Francisco, changed his life. I'm in awe of the story and the way it's told. I think Dustin Lance Black. That's hard to say. he did a magnificent job, and I want to know what you think. I want to know what you have to say.
Yeah, I would say as a movie is very enjoyable. I saw it when it first came out. I think
me too.
A large portion of the gay community had seen it when it came out, and I watched the documentary back then as well. This time I only watched the movie. I didn't go back and watch the documentary, but the movie, it still holds up. It's very enjoyable. I think Sean Penn puts in a really great performance. I know we've talked about, you know, straight actors playing gay characters before, and, you know, Sean Penn doesn't come without his own, like, controversies as an actor. Any fans of Madonna are not huge Sean Penn fans. So obviously choosing him for a gay movie where there's a huge gay audience that likes Madonna, obviously Sean Penn needs to be married to Madonna, was an interesting choice. But for him, I feel like he really gave the role, like, the love, care, and nurturing it deserved as a character. Like, it didn't feel like it was Sean Penn. It felt like he was embodying his interpretation of Harvey Milk.
Really did.
And I really appreciated that. So, you know, if you're going to do that, fine. Cast a straight actor if they're going to, like, really, really go in it. So Sean Penn, even though I have a bias against him, I was like, you know what? You did a really good job. And because it's tough with, like, a biopic, because, you know, especially the way this is structured, it kind of jumps in and out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's not always, like, you know, that perfect three-act structure, that perfect, you know, character arc, because you're just reliving disparate moments. So you really, really have to come in and out of those scenes based mainly on the lead actor and his performance. And so he kept me really engaged. I would say, you know, it's, in terms of representation, I think it was great that, you know, as Robert said, not only did they recreate Castro Camera, but they filmed the majority of the film on Castro Street.
Yes, you know, that's true.
Which, you know, obviously also helps the local economy and just adds that extra air of authenticity. Mm-hmm. Now, you know what? I'll hold off on the negatives just for now. I'll say the other positive thing is, I was shocked to find out, you know, because I'm always big on, like, narrative framing, right? Like, my favorite novel ever is Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, just because the way the narrative frame, anyway, if you read that, it's just such a unique narrative frame. And so this one, I was like, you know, with biopics, it's always interesting. We've actually done quite a few biopics lately.
Yes, we have.
On this podcast, and every single one, you know, from Rocket Man to Bohemian Rhapsody, have taken really different ways to jump in and out of different moments in these characters' lives. And with Milk, I thought, you know, it was fascinating, you know, opening the movie with, you know, that pre-recorded taping of what Harvey Milk recorded, you know, and as a viewer, because I had watched the movie before the documentary, I just thought it was, you know, like a Hollywood narrative frame, you know, like, you've got to frame the movie somehow. So then to find out that those tapes were real and you can hear the entire tape in the documentary, I thought that was really fascinating that they sort of took that real life audio recording. And obviously in this movie, they re-recorded it as opposed to, like, taking the real audio most of the time. I thought that was fascinating. I also thought it was really fascinating that they, like, interspersed, like, real life footage in, like, the Hollywood movie.
It became almost indiscernible between the two.
Yeah, so it's like you're seeing Sean Penn as Harvey Milk, but then you're seeing like archival footage of Harvey Milk as Harvey Milk. And I don't think I've ever seen that before. Like, that's a really unique way of telling a biopic. Yeah, they really took a lot of care. Now, the negative, and this might be, I promise everybody, this isn't just recency bias, because I know people don't like him, like, right now because of the Me Too movement, but I have not liked James Franco for a long time, way before the Me Too movement. I just feel like, this is an example where casting a straight guy goes wrong. Just like, why? He's just playing James Franco with a mustache. Like, that's literally, I was like, there's no, I don't know who the real life person is he's based on, if it is even a real life person, but I didn't believe him as a gay person at all. I was like, this is James Franco with a mustache, and he just needs to get out of my gay movie right now. Yeah, the other character that really kind of upset me was Diego Luna as Jack Lira. And, you know, I just think because we've seen a lot of these, you know, these gay movies lately, and, you know, and specifically gay as opposed to LGBTQ, where it's like specifically the lead character is a gay man, like, mm-hmm. where there's always this side character where it's like this tempestuous gay person that like leads them down the wrong road. Like, this Diego Luna character has been in like every, like, I just also watched the Netflix series Halston, and you know, Bohemian Rhapsody had the same character. All of them, like, there's always like this like gay entrapment tempestuous character that leads them astray, and that especially pisses me off because the real life Harvey Milk, you know, taking it out of the movie, you know, he was very much known for his advocating of like open relationships and not wanting, you know, like, you know, just talking about loving multiple people. In this movie, they made it seem like his whole goal in life was to have like a one solo partner for his whole life. And that just wasn't him. And then to put that solo partner as this tempestuous person leading him in the wrong direction, when in real life, he just had multiple partners and was openly, you know, flirtatious and, you know, he did not want like that heteronormative life at all. I just feel like, I was just like, that's just, I don't know. I didn't like that they toned down his, like, his open relationship ideology, and I especially didn't like them toning it down for having him locked into this monogamous relationship with a tempestuous, you know, entrapment gay guy who, I don't know, what are your thoughts?
Well, I don't agree with you. I just feel like the focus of the film wasn't really meant to be on his relationships in the same way. And what I found when they were addressing his relationships, whether it was this one with his one with Scott Smith, played by James Franco, or with, oh gosh, and you just said the name too. See, this is how small his part was in it. I'm not remembering the name.
Yeah, his character.
Jack Lira.
Yes, yes.
I didn't feel like the part played by Diego Luna, Jack Lira, was very, very well fleshed out necessarily. But I wasn't getting the sense that they were being built together as a monogamous relationship. I felt this was like it felt a little bit boy toy-esque, in fact, that he had like this younger Latin guy around who was definitely portrayed as being not too bright, which I'm wondering if Jack Lira is alive and is able to defend himself against that. But I feel because the focus was so much on the activism and how... Yeah. You know, considering, you know, the consultants in there who would have actually known Jack Lira, maybe their interactions with him were seeing so little of him and that's what they knew of him as a result. So I don't think it takes away from the movie. Addressing James Franco, I've James Franco, I don't think he is just James Franco in this movie, because if he was, I would have hated him a lot more. So, you know, I'm not a fan either, but I thought, like, I was able to get past the fact that it was James Franco playing it, because I thought, you know, I thought that the character, I felt like the character really cared about Harvey Milk, but And it's, of course, a relationship that didn't work out, and yet they were still friends. I thought that was built really well, that they were still friends, and I thought I felt the care that was there. But it is hard when you're bringing, when you have two iconic actors, or as many iconic actors that they have, and it is hard to separate the person from the character. I'm not really a fan of Sean Penn. This movie made me a fan of Sean Penn because he did such a good job. But it was that kiss with James Franco. He said that that was the first time he had ever kissed a man, was on screen with James Franco, which I found, I was like, oh, okay, wow. You know, yeah, I thought he would have rehearsed a bit more than that. But I do want to point out one thing about the representation, which I think is a cool script flip. I'm changing gears a little bit here. Yeah. But Dennis O'Hare, who plays the really homophobic Senator Briggs, who's trying to pass Prop 6. So Dennis O'Hare is gay, and he's playing the straightest, evilest character in the entire movie. So I was like, yeah, score one for us playing the straight villain, I guess. But I think that the actors, I wasn't distracted the way you were by who was playing it in the same way. And that's just from whatever your personal experience with these actors are in the end. And like, I don't support really either of their personal lives, but I'm going to get past it because this movie's too important.
Yeah, I didn't want to get into the negative parts because I actually do think it's a really good movie. It's really worth watching. I think it's worth watching in tandem with the documentary itself, whether you watch the documentary first or the movie first. I definitely think they are meant to go as a pair. And even the filmmaker for the, the filmmakers who made the film as opposed to the documentary said, like, you know, it's best to watch both together. And they were obviously heavily influenced by the documentary. So, you know, another negative thing. Like I said, I like this movie. I want y'all to watch it. I just got to keep it real because our podcast is called You Better Represent. And I do have to bring up a little bit of the controversy on some of the non-gay representation in the film. Because so in real life, and if you watch the documentary, like the coalition that Harvey Milk built was actually quite diverse in terms of visible minorities, women, people with disabilities, and seniors. Like his message resonated. Off the top when I was when I was giving the movie summary or synopsis, I got that from IMDb, and I actually changed a word because they said Harvey Milk fought for gay rights, but I changed it to civil rights because actually his message was much more broad. It was for all disadvantaged people. So his coalition of supporters was extremely diverse from by race, by gender, by age, and by, able-bodied and people with disabilities. And this movie did not represent that at all. It was basically a coalition of, like, white gay men. And I will say, so they ended up throwing in, like, you know, one token lesbian and one token Asian. And
yeah, in San Francisco, too.
Yeah,
there's only one.
I was going to say, San Francisco of all places. You cannot have a gay movie in San Francisco and have one Asian who, you know, on the cast list is like the 20th person named on the cast list. So I'm just like, come on, people. Like, it's just, I get it. The movie isn't totally about that, but I would have loved for them to represent. And it's in such stark contrast to the documentary as well, which just really showed he was a civil rights activist, which obviously he wanted to represent for the gays, but he was really reaching out to everybody who was disadvantaged. And they really just showed this coalition as Harvey Milk and his, like, you know, straight
gay entourage.
I was like, I don't know, y'all. I don't know. This is, I get it with movies, you have to condense, but I still gotta say it. Like, I do want to say, I like this movie, and I don't want to be, I think sometimes people get worried when they try and make a film like this, or say, like, a recent example would be In the Heights, by by Lin-Manuel Miranda. And it's like when you're doing a film that's supposed to represent a certain community, sometimes you get shit on more because you don't get it perfect. So same with that controversy. This, I'm not trying to make a controversy. So I'm saying I'd rather people try and, you know, maybe miss a detail here or there that as a podcast called You Better Represent, I have to point out. Otherwise, people are going to be like, yo, why didn't you mention that he erased all the women and the Asians from the narrative? But, you know, I don't want people to not try because they think that because you're held to a higher standard, that you're just not going to try at all. So I don't want to shit on these filmmakers or people because I think it's an amazing movie. Do I have to mention these things? Yes.
Yeah.
Do I wish they got them right? Yes. But it's a worthwhile movie, and I think they did an amazing job, and I'm glad they did this movie, and I want people to watch it.
We're going to have a lot of fun when we do the podcast about the Stonewall movie then. Let's remember this, and when we talk about Stonewall, because if you want to see whitewashing, that's the one we're gonna have to talk about. But I digress. But you're right, 100% right. It needs to be called out in 2021 so that they don't keep doing this in Hollywood.
Like
represent properly. Don't just be like, hey, we tried. Look, hey, we got an Asian guy in there. We cut most of his scenes. You know. So. I agree 100%. But as a definitely as a lesson in how gay rights started. I mean, a lot of gay rights were started by white men because of whatever the circumstances are. Because you know we're passable, and there are different ways that you know people who are straight and white might listen to a gay white man as opposed to even you know a white lesbian or a person of color, which makes it so interesting then that. That then when we do the retelling, the important parts of our history that, you know, us as white gay men aren't including and saying, hey, wait a minute, it's actually our job to say, hey, there were some other people here because, you know, we've got a little bit more privilege now and it's time for us to speak up as well. So, yeah, I agree with you 100%. Like, we should do better now that we know better.
Yeah, you know, and another reason why, you know, like obviously with the history of gay rights, as Robert mentioned with Stonewall, you know, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of history there with non-white gays. But you know, white gay men do play an important role. And I think one part, too, that I think I like that this movie mentioned is, you know, a lot of the money and wealth in the LGBTQ community, especially early on, was in the pockets of straight passing gay white men.
Yeah.
So obviously you kind of need that help to push the movement forward. So
Even watch Harvey Milk do that when he's like he arrives to San Francisco a hippie, and in order to get those white people to support him in certain areas, you know, he did the haircut, he got a suit, and really changed his entire look because he needed to do that in order to be listened to in the first place by those people, those gatekeepers and holders of power. But that it's, for me, that's just a lesson as, you know, a white gay man to, if I have that privilege to use it to uplift the others in my community and in any intersectional community that is marginalized. So that sounded like a talking point that I wrote down, but like, I do mean it.
No, absolutely, absolutely. Now, I'll throw to you, Robert, now for your final thoughts on Milk. Would you? I feel like I have a good idea, but would you recommend this? Does it hold up?
Yeah, I think it holds up for people to watch this as a civics lesson, and because there's more emotion behind a dramatized retelling that you get to feel maybe in a different way than you would by watching a documentary. So I do recommend it, but I think it's a really good recommendation that you watch the documentary side by side with it. I would be recommending that for, you know, and one thing too, talking about a biopic, one of the big differences between the ones we've watched is they included music before, you know, Rocketman and Bohemian Rhapsody, talking about those stories, there was a lot of music involved, and for there's no music to hide behind in this. It was just storytelling, and I thought it was reasonably accurate and good storytelling to then launch your interest into finding out more about what the gay and civil rights movement was in the 70s and the 60s and onward.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm in total agreement. I think, you know, outside of a few minor elements, I think they did a really great job. I think, you know, not just, you know, like the retelling of the story itself, the dramatization, I thought was amazing. The acting was really great outside of James Franco. But I think the actual structure and the way it kind of pushes biopics forward, I thought was great. Using the archival footage, using the narrative frame of his audio tapes, I just thought those were things that I've never seen in a biopic before. And, you know, I think it's like a creative choice were really, really fascinating. And I think it helps hold the movie together combined with Sean Penn being so compelling as Harvey Milk. It really kept my attention in a way that, you know, say with Bohemian Rhapsody, I was just like, when they just jumped scene to scene, I was getting lost. I had really no interest, even though, you know, Freddie Mercury should be just as compelling of a character as Harvey Milk, but basically as anybody in history. Like, he was just clearly very compelling and I was not compelled. But in this movie, they really, really, you know, kept my attention for the whole thing, from the direction to the acting and the editing. So yeah, definitely see it. And yeah, even outside of the things I said, I just want people to know I do love this movie, but I have a responsibility to say those things. So
yes. Okay,
we will be back for our second segment where we discuss a cultural topic that's plucked from the themes of the movie. And the cultural topic we're talking about this week is the importance of gay villages or LGBTQ villages and what role they play in our lives. What up, listeners? Welcome back to the You Better Represent podcast. We are now in our second segment where we discuss a cultural topic plucked from the themes of this week's movie. And this week's movie was Milk, the biopic about Harvey Milk, who was the first openly gay elected official in San Francisco. Now, you know, everybody knows San Francisco, you know, gay Mecca. You know, some people would say that the Castro is the very first gay village. Who knows? I don't know. But it's certainly one of the most important, for sure. So what I sort of wanted to talk about as our topic of the week is you know, what is the appeal of gay villages? Why did they spring up? And what do they mean overall to the community, and also in our lives as gay men now? Like, do they still have a place, and what place did they have when we were first coming out? Now, I just asked like five separate questions, so let me rewind and throw over to Robert with just one of the five questions, which is Robert, what is the importance of gay villages in your life?
Yeah, well, I do believe, like, in a lot of cases, whether we talk about visible minorities or in this case sexual minorities, these kind of enclaves and cities are often a result of persecution of that culture or that group of people. So gay villages definitely, I think, sprung up out of the need to have a place to feel safe, to have an area of the place where you live that feels safe to go about and just be yourself. And I think you could say that about, you know, any sort of neighborhood, especially in Toronto, because we are a city of neighborhoods, that the gay village was a place where, for me, when I was, you know, came out, and I was very young when I came out, not like a teenager or anything, but it was a place where I knew I could go and be as gay as I wanted to be, which was really awesome. You know, and easy to celebrate, you know, who we are when we're surrounded, like, not just in you know, like a restaurant or one club where, you know, everyone is, you know, a part of the community. But when you then walk outside those doors and know that you still have like a few blocks that you can say, this belongs to us, you know. Yeah. And of course, the downside of that being is like, people all know where all the gay people are too, if they want to pick on them. So I know that's that's something that having lived near Toronto's gay village, you know, you end up hearing about that a bit. But overall, I think it's such a positive thing. And I know that our society's grown perhaps beyond the point where they think these kind of villages for the gays are necessary. But I'm still so glad that that an enclave like that exists.
Yeah, I'm, you know, gay villages have played an interesting part in my life because, you know, the first two cities where I was out as, you know, I came out when I was in Winnipeg, but really that was just like my first year of being out. But then like the first really 5-6 years of my being out was in Calgary, where there really isn't a gay village. And not only that, but they have the nerve to say, you know, that they're proud they don't have a gay village, because I'm not speaking for the whole community. So let me just put that straight. I'm speaking from literal things that people have said to me. So whether you agree or disagree, I'm telling you facts of things people have actually said to me, not saying this is what everybody thinks. But it's not uncommon for people to say in Calgary, like, oh, we're proud we don't have a village because we don't need one, because you can, the whole city is our village. Like, we can be gay anywhere. And I'm like, no, Calgary. Like, yeah, maybe San Francisco can get away with saying that. Calgary, No, Calgary, no. You cannot, you cannot say that, Calgary. That's ridiculous.
Quite honestly, I like to joke that Calgary is the only city I know of that has a straight pride, and that's the Calgary Stampede.
Oh, but Lord.
I can only imagine that it, you know, for me, that doesn't make it easier to know that, oh, I can walk out. You cannot just walk anywhere in Calgary and, you know, wear your rainbows as much as you want and not expect to have an egg thrown at you, probably. But, and that's putting it nicely. But no. What did you think of Toronto then when you came here and saw that there was a thriving gay village?
Well, I was so excited. I was like, I can't even tell you, because so in Calgary and Winnipeg, like, even though there wasn't a village, there were like, you know, queer establishments or places people hung out. There just wasn't like a neighborhood. It would just be like basically one or two places in the whole city. I know that sounds really sad if you're from a larger city like Toronto, but yeah, that's basically all you had. But you would hang out at like the one gay club. But in Toronto, when I moved here, so I drove to Toronto, and my ex-boyfriend was already living in Toronto, so I sort of stayed with him for the first few months of moving to Toronto. And this is probably more detail than people need, but when I first got here, I drove in, and it was very early in the day, and he was still at work. So, like, literally, I just drove to the village, and I just sat on a bench and just, like, stared at people, like, walking up and down the street, and I was like, all these people are gay, or, you know, they're not, but I'm saying that I know literally not everybody's gay, but, like, in my brain, I was like,
all these gay people.
Yeah, I could just stare at all these gay people, have these gay people stare back at me. I don't know what I was expecting. Maybe, I don't know if I thought, like, people just randomly come up and talk to me. Probably not, because if you're sitting at a bench staring creepily at people, they're not going to come up and talk to you. But I was just so, you know, I was like 25 or 26 at the time. I just sort of sat there. Literally, so my first experience in Toronto was like parking my car and sitting in the gay village for probably at least 8 hours, just staring, as I was waiting for my ex-boyfriend to get off of work so I could like drop off my luggage. And honestly, I know in Toronto, like, the village has morphed a bit, and there's like, you know, you could say there's like separate villages, you know, some people would say, you know, there's a lot of queer people concentrated on Queen Street West or other places. Yeah. So it's maybe not as concentrated to like the one village, but for me, and I would say for my friendship group, which, you know, for me, any city that I go to, when I know nobody, I just join every like gay sports league ever. So like I'll literally be part of like 6 sports leagues at the same time. Literally 6 out of the 7 days, I'm like playing a different gay sport. And at least for the gay athletes, at least like the village is still the place. Like anytime we have a gathering, like a team gathering, even if you make it like one block outside of the village, so there's like, so for people outside of Toronto, like the Toronto Gay Village is, you know, is on a Church Street, and you know, there's two streets to the left and right. There's Yonge Street, and then there's Jarvis Street. Literally, if you try and make these gays walk that one block over to Yonge Street or to Jarvis Street, you get only 30% of the attendance you would get by having it on actual Church Street. So there is like, there is still something, at least for that, Blaze. The LGBTQ community is so huge that I know for certain pockets of it, like Queen West is like a bigger part of their lives. But at least for the circles I'm in, like it's still a huge, huge like gathering place. And even one block away does not count for some people. I don't know, like Robert, what like did the, like how, like what role did it play for you coming out in your life now?
Well, for sure. I mean, I came out in Victoria, and it was the same. Like as you were saying about smaller centers, there's like, you're lucky if there's one bar, or you know, it's always a bar or a coffee shop or something like that. And so Toronto was a big difference to see all these, you know, gay owned businesses and all being attended by queer people or queer adjacent people, and you know, watching it thrive as much as it does as well. And yes, there have been changes over the year, but I know for me, I mean, I've been desperate to try and just get a comedy show going in the village that's also accessible. That's one of the other problems about Toronto is there's just so many stairs everywhere in Toronto. So trying to get a comedy show or any sort of show that's accessible for people in mobility devices is very difficult. And the Gayborhood's no exception for that. That's one place where if we are going to move forward, that's one thing I'd like to see a little bit more of in regards to inclusion. But yeah, I mean, it was important, like going, like, you know, I was seeing drag shows, you know, and, you know, iconic drag queens like Chris Edwards or, you know, more recently, Sofonda Cox, seeing these performers and just people living their best queer lives, which was not something I was seeing as much in my small center. And I think that's one of the greatest things about a gay village is that you're seeing people at their queerest and unapologetically queer. And I love that. That's my favorite thing about being in a gay village.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's, I don't know. I love the Toronto gay village. There's obviously, you know, ups and downs, like for Canadians, like living very close to, like we're 5 hours away from Montreal. And sometimes in Toronto, you kind of think, how is Montreal's like gay village like five times the size of ours? Like it's so huge. And ours is, you know, just kind of confined to a very short distance. But I would say like even during the pandemic, it's played a huge role in my life because I would like walk up to the gay village and then turn back and come back down as like sort of my daily walk, especially early on in the pandemic. And, you know, I think even when like businesses started opening up and the village had like more patio space than probably it's ever had in its history because of, you know, people couldn't eat inside. So the city allowed all these, you know, chairs and tables out, you know, they blocked out like two of the four lanes on the street. It almost made it even cooler and more of like a gathering area. And you know, and I know like it's October now, and with Halloween coming up, I think the Queer Village, probably my favorite night in Toronto's Queer Village, is Halloween. And I know like it's not even that specifically of like a queer event because you have like a lot of like straight people coming, but I just think it's just, I don't know, it's just such a celebration that night.
It's a great party for sure.
And you know, obviously you get like all types of costumes, but you also get like really amazing like queer costumes as well. And I love that like the epicenter of Halloween, not just queer Halloween, but just like Halloween as a whole in Toronto is in the village. And I definitely love that. You know, at certain parts of the year we can attract a broader audience. Now, you know, let's keep it real. I do like that for the most part. Like most of the year outside of Halloween, it is predominantly queer, which, you know, I'm not straight phobic. I'm just saying it's nice to have our own place. But for Halloween and different social events, it is nice when like everybody kind of comes into the village. And I think it's a special place for me for sure.
Yeah, definitely a lot of, like, if I were to talk about different coming of age stories, a lot of them would be associated with the village. So, and obviously it plays such an important role for, a lot of people probably in our generation in particular who needed a place to go, when, you know, you're not feeling like the world around you is accepting you. So, I hope that the village has gone through in the last while, you know, some ups and downs is in regards to the businesses there and, you know, people saying, oh, it's not cool to be in the village anymore or whatever, you know, like all the, you know, the people are that were like, oh, it's passé. And it's like, oh no, it's cool again. And so like, I hope that through those cycles that people just realize the value of having your own space like that, as the group that we are. And also one of the things going forward is making that space more accessible and welcoming to perhaps the queer people that we have not been paying the attention that we should be. But with anchors like the 519 Center, you know, that's such an important space in our Toronto community. I feel like with that there, the Gay Village is going to be around for decades to come, which is comforting, you know?
Yeah. You know, definitely. And, you know, I couldn't have said it better myself. I think sort of, you know, adding on a little bit to the topic, just because of the movie that we watched this week being Milk. I do like that there are a lot more queer people running for office to represent our village. You know, obviously with our city councilor, Kristen Wong Tam.
Yes.
You know, and I know we've had second place in the federal in the recent federal election was a gay Asian man, which I thought was amazing.
Oh yeah, I voted for him. Brian, right?
Yeah, Brian Chang, yeah. I believe. And and provincially, I believe the Liberal candidate is also a gay man whom I know from volleyball, from gay volleyball. Oh. So he is super legit. So
and
definitely.
In my riding, it's a bisexual woman who is our MPP. So there we go. Represent.
Yeah, I love that we're seeing this happen, and you know, Harvey Milk was a pioneer in that space, and it's good having these choices. Okay, well, that brings us to an end of this fascinating episode. I want to thank all our listeners, and also, of course, I want to thank my co-host Robert Watson for coming on. We will be back with another episode every week, obviously. If you're subscribed to this, you will hopefully be back with us next week. And I'm your host, Vong Show, and that's what's up.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Sonar Network. Sonar.